spirit of equal time, we now have Lorna Smith joining us. Lorna, can you hear me?
I can, Paul.
Lorna, thank you so much for being here today. Just for anybody just tuning in now, we are doing a Conversations with Candidates on Filter, specifically this time around, candidates for the County Board of County Commissioners, District 2, which basically represents or essentially represents areas of like Port Hadlock, Chimicum, Maristone, Cape George. And we talked to Heidi Eisenhower in the first hour, and now we're talking to Lorna Smith, the other candidate for this position. And welcome, Lorna. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Paul. And one thing I want to remind the voters right off the bat is everyone who's a registered voter in Jefferson County can vote in this race. So it's, even though we represent District 2, the whole county gets to vote.
That's an important reminder that in the primary, you could only vote in your district. But in this general election, you, just because you live in Port Townsend or Quilcene, you can still vote for District 2. Thank you for that.
Exactly.
Lorna. Well, so the format we're looking at here today is the first segment before we play a song that you brought. I want to talk just about you. We can kind of connect, you know, you can connect it to policies, but I want a chance for the listeners just to get to know who Lorna Smith is and learn about you. And then we'll get into some policy questions in the second half. But I wanted to ask right off the bat, what is your connection to Jefferson County? Tell us a little bit about that. And yeah.
Well, I have some interesting connections to Jefferson County, some that go back pretty long ways. One in particular began in 1903 when my paternal grandparents arrived in Jefferson County in the westernmost part of the county on Destruction Island. My grandfather was a lighthouse keeper there, and he arrived there as a lonely married man without his wife and son, and spent a few lonely months there before his wife and son got to join him. So my family are mariners and lighthouse keepers, and that's one of my connections.
Wow.
A couple others are that back in the 80s, when I was a young, just getting started on a career and a young wife and mother, I got involved with Eleanor Stops in the campaign to protect Protection Island and ended up partnering with her on that campaign the whole way through. We made several trips together back to Washington, D.C. We rallied the troops together. I did a little more of the political side. She did a little more of the getting her Seabird adoption program up and going. But we were an excellent team, and together we got a lot of support and were able to get that bill passed back in Congress to create Protection Island National Wildlife Refuge. So
wow.
There's a couple of connections early on. And then, of course, I've been here for almost 10 years now, living at Cape George. And I'm a fifth-generation Washingtonian born on the shores of the Salish Sea. So
there you go.
I feel right at home here.
Yeah. Well, let me dial back to Destruction Island. So there isn't a lighthouse on Destruction Island anymore, right?
There is, but it's automatic now.
Oh, okay. Because is Destruction Island the one that you can see off of Ruby Beach?
Ruby Beach.
Is that the one? Because I know there's one. I thought there was one sort of at the end of the peninsula called Destruction Island, and it was like a little. It was almost like a rock where.
Yes, that is Destruction Island. So Catoosh Island and Destruction Island are both off the coast. Destruction Island's a little further south as you look at the map. So it's right where that finger of Jefferson County, you know, extends across the Olympics and hits the coast there, that very strange shape of the county. And right at the tip is Destruction Island.
And I think I read that the story of that island getting its name was that a ship wrecked there and that the folks on it decided to go to the mainland and then were immediately killed on the beach by the first peoples who were already living there.
That's the story. My grandparents had a much friendlier welcome by the local Aleut folks. And in fact, I'm looking at right now in my curio cabinet a couple of very precious baskets that were woven by the Aleut people and gifted to my grandmother. And the quality of these this basket making back at that time was just absolutely amazing. And I've been thinking, you know, maybe I should see if there's a way for me to now give those back to the Quileutes, because there's not a lot of these, you know, these baskets over 100 years old now, and they're very precious. So
what's the life of a lighthouse keeper in 1903? I mean, what do you have any sort of picture of what that looked like for your grandparents?
Oh boy. I mean, that life, that was really, imagine just being that remote. Because even getting off and on the island back then was very treacherous. They had to be lifted up with a hoist, and all of their supplies had to be delivered that way. There was no beach or dock. The you know, landing craft operator had to be very skilled to kind of just back up against the rock, and the hoist would come down. So, you know, very lonely, kind of harsh life. And then my grandparents went from that lighthouse to having the lighthouse at Mukilteo. What a change that had to be for them, because they could just walk up the hill there and get on the interurban, you know, trolley back in those days. So I'm sure for my grandmother that was a nice change.
Yeah. I mean, that's it, because the very stakes, and then at least being a little bit closer to society, you know, than being hoisted out of a tiny island. How long would they stay there for?
Well, you know, most lighthouse assignments at that time seemed to be 5 to 6 years, and then they would rotate to somewhere else. So my grandparents ended up at many of the lighthouses around the Salish Sea. They had Dungeness. My father actually went to the Dungeness Schoolhouse, which is now a community center, and they had to row him across to that, what was that very long, mile-long dock. You can still see the piers for it out there. They'd drop him off, and then he would walk into the school. So they were there, you know, also for about 4 or 5 years. We have pictures of my dad out there with a pet seal, which was, you know, allowed or at least overlooked back then.
You couldn't have a pet seal now, I think. That's probably,
no,
that's probably off limits.
No.
We're in a different world.
Marine Mammal Protection Act, yes.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about, I want to talk about Protection Island too, but a little bit about your work with the Seattle Audubon Society?
Well, I have always been very conservation-minded and have always been an activist, you know, from high school right on. You know, I was a child of the 60s, so it's kind of in my blood. And very early on, I started volunteering for the Seattle Wild Bird Center when there was a huge oil spill on Whidbey Island. And my dad and I were out there picking up oil-soaked birds, and so many of them didn't make it. And it inspired me, angered me, to think, you know, just trying to save one bird at a time isn't the way to address this problem. And so then I got involved with Seattle Audubon, which was very much into conservation issues at that time, which led me to getting involved eventually with the project to stop the campaign to stop the Northern Tier Pipeline proposal. So that was another project that, even though I was at Seattle Audubon as a volunteer and chair of the Conservation Committee, I was involved with people out here in Jefferson County and Clallam County working to stop that project, which we did after a lot of hard work on the part of a lot of people.
Yeah. So, and you said in the beginning that you live in Cape George. So do you have a view of Protection Island where you live?
I do. I mean, when we came back here from 4 years doing conservation work in Costa Rica, and we were looking for a place to buy, my mother was at the Life Care Center in Port Towns, and we needed to be close to her in her last time. And we walked up on the porch of this house, turned around and looked out and saw Protection Island and Dungeness Light, where my grandparents were, and we just said, okay, we'll take it. And they said, don't you want to see inside the house?
Just like, nope, don't even need to see.
No, this is home, and it really is home. You know, coming from a family of mariners, we're just a couple of blocks up from the beach, and it's just an amazing place to be.
That's great. So my understanding of Protection Island is that no one can go on there except for marine biologists and one person who had a family sort of heritage connection to the island. Is that the case? Is that how it works?
Yes, and that's part of an interesting story if you want to hear that.
Yeah.
So I was asked in a forum last week to give an example of a time that I really had to compromise. Well, this is a good example, because when Eleanor and I, backed by many Audubon activists across the country, were back in Washington, D.C., testifying for the bill once we managed to get it introduced, there were people who owned, you know, Protection Island at that time was divided up into 800 residential postage stamp size lots. And people wanted to, you know, stay out there. And this was a willing seller acquisition. You know, we knew from the start that if there were a lot of objections to a buyout program, that it wasn't going to, it just was, the bill wasn't going to pass. So in the end, a compromise was worked out where several parties were allowed lifetime tenancy. And of course, then the value of their property was, which would eventually end up with the government, but the property was devalued by the, you know, the time they spent there, you know, as renters, if you will. So yes, right now there is one intrepid soul who still has a house out there. He is part of our Cape George community here too, because he has a lot and his boat comes and goes from here. So a lot of people know Marty Blue Water, and you know, he lives out there at least part of the time with the birds. And
oh wow. So he's actually not just visiting there, he's staying there for long periods of time.
Yes, he has a house there, so.
Wow. And so he probably has to bring his own water and
yes.
And deal with all, yep. You know, that's so. And I mean, that's yeah, you're right. That is an interesting example of compromise for the sake of preserving the nature. And it's one that runs out eventually, I bet.
Yes. Yeah. It won't pass to any heirs. It's Marty's to enjoy as long as he wants to do that. And so that.
Can he invite guests out there?
Well, sure. You know, I know he does kind of discreetly, and, you know, we never see big parties happening out there or anything. And there are some research projects that go on out there. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who manages the island, they, you know, they have a caretaker who is there, I think, primarily in the summer months. So there's a little bit of people presence on the island, but not very much.
So what are some other conservation projects that you've worked on in Jefferson County?
Well, those two primarily before I even ever moved here, the Northern Tier Pipeline project, which was proposed to be an oil port in Port Angeles and then an underwater pipeline that would have gone up and over Protection Island, up and over Whidbey Island before hitting the mainland somewhere in the vicinity of Anacortes. And just a really horrible idea, this underwater pipeline. So that was kind of the beginning of the real awareness of just how fragile Puget Sound, and that was before we even used that term, Salish Sea, were. But some local folks, Norma Turner from Port Angeles, kind of headed up the No Oil Port campaign. And I was their counterpart from the mainland, if you will, to get a bunch of conservation support for the effort to stop that pipeline. So that lobbying took place primarily in Olympia. And in the end, after a lot of hard work and pressure and letter writing and testifying, finally John Spellman just vetoed the project and put it, you know, to bed once and for all.
Got it. And were you also involved at the Tarboo Ridge, that recent effort to, you know, prevent the gun range from going up into that area?
Well, as you probably know, I've been serving Jefferson County now for the last 8 years, both on the Conservation Futures Committee and then the Planning Commission, you know, as a volunteer. And in my role on the Planning Commission, we had the, you know, the gun range ordinance come before us. And in the first attempt, the Planning Commission's recommendations were, I'm going to use the word discarded, by the Board of County Commissioners, and they, you know, passed their own version, which was then appealed to the Growth Management Hearings Board by the Tarboro Ridge Coalition. So I wasn't part of the Tarboro Ridge Coalition. That's a, you know, a separate citizen group. But when the hearing examiner, when the Growth Management Hearings Board kicked the appeal back to the county, they actually sent it all the way back to the Planning Commission. So we got another shot at it. And that's when, frankly, Cynthia Cohen, my fellow Planning Commission member, and I came up with the idea to write an ordinance for an indoor-only gun range. And so, yes, I was the primary author of that and eventually got the Planning Commission to unanimously accept it, and then the Board of County Commissioners unanimously passed it. So, yeah, I'm pretty proud of the role I played in that because, again, that was a great compromise. It seemed to satisfy, you know, the greatest number of people. Not everybody was completely happy, but one thing it did was a grandfather. Well, it would, you know, because the existing sportsman's facility was grandfathered, it was not part of this ordinance. So there's a shooting range, an outdoor shooting range that's already permitted. They recently got a permit, I think, for the next 20 years. And now the next shooting range that's constructed in the county will be an indoor range if and when that happens. So a good compromise, I think.
Well, tell us a little bit about, before we get into your song, tell us a little bit about your family out here and maybe elsewhere. Give us a little details about Lorna Smith's family, extended and close.
Okay, well, my husband and I have been married for 30 years, and we have five children from a family that was blended many years ago, as you can guess, having been married 30 years. So we have grown children in Ballard and Bothell and Everett and Los Angeles.
Wow.
And then my sister and brother-in-law live right here in Cape George also. They're just a couple blocks away. And I have a brother in Port Orchard. So we're able to get together quite often. And we're all, you know, we all have that sea water in our blood and like to get out and recreate in boats and on the beach. So it's great having my siblings near at hand.
That's awesome. So can you give us a little background on the song that you brought for us today?
Okay. So the name of this song is Back Up a Little Bit. It's a rockabilly song. It's very high energy. And I love it primarily because my son, Kevin Campion, who's captain of the ship Orion, the yawl Orion, that is well known in Port Townsend. The co-op refurbished her, so she's beloved here. So he plays the steel guitar and sings on this song. So it's I love the song. Hope you will too.
And is he does he live in Seattle or does he live just on the boat?
Well, he lives on the boat, but he does have a house in Ballard, and the boat goes back and forth between Port Townsend and Shilshoal Marina, but she's been kind of mothballed, if you will, because of COVID. So she's right now, Orion is there at Shilshoal, and he's not taking passengers out right now, sadly, because it's students that he takes out, and they study marine mammals and oceanography, so... that's not happening this year.
Shaving a haircut, great way to end. That was Western Bluebirds. Back up a bit. What role does your son play in the group?
He sings and he plays the steel guitar, so he was the second voice coming in. So, yeah, I love the music.
That's great. Well, thank you for sharing it with us. We're talking to Lorna Smith, a candidate for District 2 County Commissioner. So we're going to do the same questions we did in the first hour and just give everybody a chance to talk about these things. So my first question, the question that every candidate loves to be asked, Why are you running for office, Lorna Smith?
I'm running for Jefferson County Commissioner because I believe I have experience and foresight and to bring to the office. I've been serving on the Jefferson County Planning Commission and the Jefferson County Conservation Futures Committee now for over 8 years, and I've gotten to know the county and the politics very, very well. I worked for local government for most of my career at over 25 years at Snohomish County, supervising environmental and land use programs. So it's really my cup of tea. It's what I've done. And at this point in my life, I believe in public service and giving to the community, and I'm willing to step forward and do that.
All right. So tell us a little bit about what your platform is.
Well, areas that I want to concentrate on are, first and foremost, of course, is helping the county recover from COVID. That just has to be the number one focus. Getting our economy back on our feet, taking care of the needs of our health care system. So that's going to shift priorities around. We have to make that happen. We have to work with the other local jurisdictions, the city, all the county agencies, the private nonprofits, to see what kind of funding assistance we can bring into the county from the federal government, from the state government. We're going to need that. As you probably know, the both the eviction moratorium and then the subsidization of unemployment from the federal government are due to come to an end very soon. And we're going to see that affect us here in Jefferson County. And we're going to be called on to step up and try to help even more than we have in the past. The Jefferson Community Foundation has been just amazing in raising funds to help fill some of those gaps. But boy, the burden is about to get worse. So that's the number one priority. Once we get things kind of in a settled place along that line, then I want to see this county focus on bringing in green jobs. I think that's going to be an important factor in restoring our economy. And then, of course, we have to address the issue head on of affordable housing and housing for the homeless. We have one of the highest burdened rates for renters in this county, where I think it's 40% of renters in this county spend more than a third of their income on rent, and that's a very high rate compared to other places in the county. We don't want to see businesses close down because they don't have workers, because the workers can't afford to live here. It's just a conundrum we're going to have to address. And I've worked on affordable housing projects in Snohomish County. I'm ready to step up and do it here in Jefferson County.
All right. Well, let me ask you this about just sort of, anyone can agree we're in a very polarized time. And if you don't feel polarized, then I mean, I don't know what to say to you. It might be in a different reality. County, so county employees and constituents may be very different from you politically. You may even find some of their ideas abhorrent, let's say. How do you anticipate representing people you not only disagree with, but may see as part of the problem, especially at a time when emotions and divisiveness are running so high?
Well, I try not to put people into categories like that. I've always worked with people of diverse views, diverse backgrounds, diverse points of views and priorities. As a government employee, I had to do that. And I enjoy meeting people with new ideas. I don't know everything, and I'm not stuck in a rut where I think it's my ideas or the highway sort of thing. I want to learn from all of our constituents. I'm going to listen. My door's going to be open, and I'm going to represent all of the people of the county, not just those who think exactly like me. What a boring world we would live in, frankly, if we all thought alike. So I look forward to that. I'm not put off by it. We have a neighbor here, frankly, in Cape George, who I don't even know if I dare say this name on the radio, but he's working on the CULP campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And he happens to like the things I stand for, and he likes the fact that he knows that I'm open and I listen. So, frankly, I think I'm going to get his vote, believe it or not. So I'm very used to working with diverse groups of people and making sure that everybody's point of view is listened to and considered.
Thank you. Yeah, and I mean, I think that's a part of your district is that, you know, there really is a lot, a need for you to be able to cross the aisle as much as that's possible, you know, hopefully with reality grounding both sides. It's sad that it has to be sides that we think about these things.
I try not to think about it in sides, frankly. You know, when we pass the Protection Island bill, now that was maybe a different world, you could say. But we lined up Republicans and Democrats to sponsor that bill. And we can get there again in this state. I know we can because that's who we are. And Jefferson County can help lead the way on that, I believe.
Well, I think there are some distinct sides when it comes to an issue like the Tri-Area Sewer, which has been, you know, for a long time promised and almost seemingly mothballed. And now, you know, looking like it has some new hope and promise for actually being built. So I wanted to check in with you on that project, you know, speaking of the specific, you know, the beginning of the sewer in the Port Hadlock area and, you know, find out, are you a proponent? Are you, you know, where do you stand on the Tri-Area Sewer and whether or not it should be fully implemented as it's been designed so far?
Frankly, we're not at a point where we can give a definitive answer to that question. Nobody really can. Right now, we're very much in a feasibility mode with that project. As you probably know, they've done a lot of revision in the design. They've scaled it back. The benefit area is now smaller than it originally was proposed, the whole intent being that if it can be built in modules into the future, that maybe we can at least get this first module funded. There are some problems with that in that now each individual hookup has to have its own grinder pump. And, you know, what I know about those is that they can be kind of iffy maintenance-wise. So how are we going to address that issue? There's still a sizable shortfall in funding. We have an opportunity to apply for some federal assistance dollars, which the county has done. I think the maximum they can receive through that is $10 million. The price tag is more like $23 million. So that would be a big step in the right direction, but how are we going to fund the rest of it? What I've told the community is that I'm going to watch this move forward. I'm not going to stand in the way of it moving forward at this point. I think we need to see if there is a feasible solution. But to me, a feasible solution means that we're not going to build this project on the financial backs of local small businesses and people living there. The price tag's going to have to be realistic across the board. So that's why, you know, I am in a study mode with the project right now. I could see that it could offer some benefit to the community, certainly allow for some business expansion and hopefully even maybe some housing construction. But those things are, you know, far from a given at this point. So that's where I am on the sewer.
You know, ironically, I had a rather disgusting conversation yesterday about grinder pumps. but that was in the city, different world. But yeah, I mean, as I understand, those are, I mean, pretty much with any new development, at least you do in the city, you're almost, you know, I think close to guaranteed to having to put in a grinder pump if there isn't one, you know, adjacent to your property already. So that's a cost that I hadn't thought of. And, you know, I mean, maybe is the... And your understanding of it is the county, would the county be footing the bill for that, or would that go into, you know, the additional hookup charges that would go to the individual landowners and homeowners?
Right now, it seems to be that it's penciled out that is going to be part of the responsibility of the individual getting the hookup. So the cost that we've looked at, that everybody's seen, that $23 million price tag for phase one, that only goes to the edge of everybody's property. So it doesn't include the pipe or the pump or maintenance from the roadway hookup to the house or the business. That's my understanding.
Well, let me ask you this. Without, you know, significant infrastructure improvements to Port Hadlock and the area, how will you meet the demand for more density to create essentially affordable housing, either by, you know, trickle-down density, whatever that I just made that up, but if you understand the concept, it's building more density to yeah. provide for more homes in general. Maybe we shouldn't call anything trickle down. That's more polarized, but especially we shouldn't call things trickle down after talking about grinder pumps. We're in a crisis countywide. I mean, countrywide, we're in a crisis, but I mean, you know, in the last interview, you know, Heidi pointed out I'm a realtor, and yes, I am. And at that point, I should have shared, you know, some of the recent facts that came into my understanding. And that's that in our county, in the last all summer, has been averaging 55% cash only sales. And that is a complete incongruity with the rest of the state. We have a housing market that is basically impenetrable. For most working class folks. So, you know, tying into the tri-area sewer and not saying that that's the solution, but it could potentially be with more infrastructure, making things easier to build. Where do you see, and you know, where, how, you know, I know affordable housing is in your platform, but how do you see yourself as being an effective creator or encourager of the creation of affordable cost of living housing?
So I do have experience in this field from having worked in Snohomish County. And let me just give you an example of a project that we did there that worked. And it was using a density bonus approach and even some transfer of development rights. So a developer came forward to the county with a plan to put housing on a piece of project that was kind of a mosaic of wetlands and even some streams on the property. And, you know, obviously he could not just put houses on there like a checkerboard. You know, it was going to have to be way more creative than that. So we worked with that developer to give him bonuses, density bonuses, meaning he could build more houses on smaller lots by preserving the wetlands and streams in open space. So density bonuses like that are a way to, you know, drive down the cost of housing. But you still, you know, there we had sewer available, that within striking distance anyway. Here, throughout much of the county, sewers aren't available. And septic systems are, you know, what we have to build, and they can be very pricey. So I want to see this county and the health district working to at least try some pilot projects to see what kind of alternative sewage treatment projects can we implement that would not be quite so pricey as your standard, you know, pump up to a sand filter kind of septic system, which can run $30,000 to $60,000 and more. So right there, that's a big chunk of, you know, a price for a house, and makes it kind of unaffordable. So one of the biggest impediments to affordable housing is that. And then, of course, the fact that we have such large lots throughout the county, and I'm in favor of, you know, establishing some tiny house villages, maybe with shared drain fields. The PUD right now manages a number of community drain fields. I'm not sure they're the perfect solution, but I think we need to look at those. So there are a variety of things. Housing trusts is another model that's been used elsewhere, where the housing trust actually owns the underlying land, and then individuals can build equity by, you know, helping to build their home on that land, and then when they sell it, you know, there's hopefully they've realized some equity growth. So these are various mechanisms that are out there, and I think we need to explore as many of them as we possibly can, because housing is definitely at a real crunch in Jefferson County.
Yeah, and one more thing on housing, because you brought up housing trusts. Do you see, you know, that as because we have one housing trust in Homeward Bound in Jefferson yeah. County, and then also I believe that there's another housing trust being formed, but it's already connected to another organization, and I'm not sure if that's public knowledge yet. So maybe I won't say that too loudly, but
yeah.
Do you see that as being part of the county's responsibility to implement and create these solutions, or more from the cheerleading perspective?
Well, even more than a cheerleading perspective, I think county governments can be very instrumental in bringing appropriate players together and helping them find the resources. I think that's a very important role for counties to play. So we have, you mentioned the Homeward Bound. There's Bayside Housing, who's doing such really good things for looking at solutions to homeless housing and transitional housing. My hat's off to them. We need to work with those, private foundations and see if maybe we can be a conduit to funding for them from the federal government, the state government. There are programs out there that can help to, funding programs that can help set up housing trusts. So that's a role that I think the county can play.
All right. Well, Lorna, we're almost out of time. Do you have any shout outs or final messages that you want to give to our listeners before we tune out?
Well, while I've got this opportunity, I'm on the air. I want to shout out to my team of several hundred volunteers that has worked so hard on this campaign. I just came here from a big sign-waving event, and the enthusiasm has been incredible. I want to thank them sincerely, and then I just want to say to the voters of Jefferson County, I hope I can have your vote, and I hope I've earned it.
That's right. Well, thank you, and the best of luck to you, Lorna. Thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me, Paul. It was fun.
Oh, good. You take care, and best of luck.